It's Tuesday, June 30th, and a bunch of abortion clinics would be out of business right now if not for John Roberts. We start here. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court overturns a law tailor-made to test abortion precedent.
His vote in this case is guided solely by the fact that we already decided this.
Why the Chief Justice said liberals messed up the first time around and still took their side to swing the case. Members of Congress were briefed on a shadowy Russian plot, and still, the president wasn't.
Don't you want to know whatever you can?
Why the White House said he doesn't need to know the facts behind the story concerning national security officials. And it doesn't quite have the same ring as you're fired.
It's almost certainly because of the election.
You're deplatformed. Why several tech companies are taking down content, even if it's from the president himself. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Of all the cases we've been waiting for from the Supreme Court, this case about abortion was at the top of the list.
This involves a Louisiana law that would restrict access to abortion, according to critics, requiring doctors in that state to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals.
But 4 years ago, the Supreme Court overturned a really, really similar law from Texas. Even Louisiana lawmakers said it was nearly identical.
The court striking down a Texas law that required abortion providers have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital.
So you might have been thinking, yesterday morning, what's going on? The only thing that has changed are the justices themselves. That was exactly the point.
It is my profound honor to be the first president in history to attend the March for Life.
Since President Trump's inauguration, he has appointed two new justices, including Brett Kavanaugh, who's way more conservative than the old swing vote Anthony Kennedy. The question going into yesterday was, would this new, more conservative court undo what was done by their predecessors? Well, yesterday morning, we learned the answer. It was no. That law is gone as well, but only because of the court's new swing vote. Let's talk to Melissa Murray, a professor at New York University's School of Law, who's written extensively about reproductive law. Professor Murray, can you walk me through the actual law in question here in Louisiana? What is it?
Sure. It's what's known as an admitting privileges law, and it requires abortion providers in the state of Louisiana to have admitting privileges at hospitals within a 30-mile vicinity of the clinic where they perform abortions. And so the idea here, or the purported rationale, is that this would allow for the credentialing of abortion providers.
This isn't about abortion being legal. It's about women's safety.
All women should be treated with dignity and should be protected in these cases that something goes wrong in Louisiana.
However, abortion providers say that it's really just a means of limiting access to abortion and shutting down the number of abortion providers because they're not actually able to get these admitting privileges because many of the hospitals don't allow abortion providers to have admitting privileges.
This law would restrict the abortion providers in Louisiana to one in New Orleans for the nearly 10,000 women every year who seek abortion services.
In most cases, it's actually not necessary to have admitting privileges at a hospital. Most abortions are provided on an outpatient basis, and the patients don't need to go to the hospital. And even if there is a complication, hospitals are required to accept patients in an emergency basis, regardless of whether they're abortion patients or not.
It's clear that this law is about ideology. It's not about safety. And the real fear is that if you restrict access in the state of Louisiana, what is the outcome?
Admitting privileges don't really serve the point. That's what the abortion providers say. But Louisiana says that it's necessary to ensure that providers are operating with the best credentials.
Based on a precedent that's only 4 years old, the Supreme Court is essentially saying here, just because one president picks a different justice doesn't mean the law automatically changes.
Well, and so the court came out yesterday and basically said, yeah, what we said before still stands. Like, this kind of a law is illegal. The vote was 5-4. Like, John Roberts came over and joined the liberals again. I mean, he sounds like he was the swing vote, at least here.
I think that's exactly right. So the majority here all said, I said what I said 4 years ago in the case Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt, where they struck down an identical Texas law.
In a 5-3 decision, Justice Kennedy, the swing vote, joined the court's four liberals to rule that the restrictions went too far.
Chief Justice Roberts, who was in the dissent in Whole Women's Health, signed on with the liberal wing of the court. And it seemed that his interest in this was not a change of heart in abortion, but really an interest in preserving the legitimacy of past precedents. So he
said, so he voted no last time, like this law should be legal, but now this time he's saying it should be illegal.
Well, he said that if we said it was illegal in the last case, then because this is identical, it should be illegal here.
But once again, it was Chief Justice John Roberts who declined to go with the conservatives, choosing stability and precedent and caution in the law rather than rapid change made by this court.
So this is the interesting part. There are a lot of people who are cheering Chief Justice John Roberts and questioning whether he's had a change of heart and he's now newly liberal, but he's really not. And he's being very clear about that here. He says his vote in this case is guided solely by the fact that we already decided this in this exact same case 4 years ago. And so there's no need to go back on that. Now, to be really clear, this is a very narrow decision. And when he writes his own separate opinion, joining the court's four liberals, he is completely clear that while stare decisis has led him here, he is no fan of the earlier opinion that he is siding with. In fact, he really questions the logic and reasoning of that earlier 2016 opinion, and indeed actually writes words that would seem to undermine the force of that opinion going forward.
It is an important precedent of the Supreme Court. By it, I mean Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Been reaffirmed many times. Casey is precedent on precedent.
But wait. So if John Roberts is saying, you know, you use the legal term stare decisis, John Roberts is basically saying we can't undo this because we got to respect past precedent. If that's the only thing that's holding him back, it sounds like there were four conservative justices, the minority, who did not see the need to hold that same precedent. So if the goal here was to feel out whether the Supreme Court might just upend past abortion rulings, it sounds like John Roberts is the only thing standing in the way of some anti-abortion activists.
For sure. To be really clear here, Chief Justice Roberts is on board with this particular precedent because it's very narrowly in the vein of this particular case. This case is exactly like the old case. But the conservative wing of the court is very comfortable with revisiting precedent. Clarence Thomas, last term in a case called Gamble versus United States, said that we have to completely rethink the Supreme Court's approach to stare decisis and its fidelity to past precedent. And in fact, he said, we have an obligation to overrule decisions of the past that were clearly and demonstrably erroneous. And of course, the question is, what counts as demonstrably erroneous for this purpose? We don't know, but perhaps it's just what five members of the court think was decided wrongly in the past.
Yeah, fascinating vote here. And the bottom line for now is these types of admitting privilege laws in this form are illegal throughout the U.S. Melissa Murray from NYU, thank you.
Thanks so much.
If Russian spies were paying Taliban fighters for every American service member they could kill, you'd want to know about it, right? Well, as military officials told news outlets about this alleged plot, President Trump said he'd never been briefed on it, and neither, apparently, had Congress. Well, that changed yesterday, at least for some congressional members, but even as they were getting briefed, the White House said President Trump has still not really been told the extent of these potential attacks. ABC's chief global affairs correspondent Martha Raddatz is with us. Martha, we've been told this bounty program existed. There have been reports it was successful in some ways. What do we know about this?
There are some reports, the Washington Post, New York Times are reporting that it is possible that this Russian bounty plot was successful and that the Taliban, after receiving money from Russians, were able to kill U.S. service members. They are looking at specific cases of service members, U.S. service members, that were lost in Afghanistan. But we know of no proof of that yet. And in fact, that would be a pretty hard thing to prove unless they had anything very solid on that.
Something doesn't smell right here, especially when we have a president and an administration who has a great deal of trouble telling the truth. We need answers, and we need them fast.
Well, and so members of both parties in both chambers of Congress were like, you know, we need to know more about this immediately. It looked like only Republicans, though, were invited to the White House for briefings. Democrats are apparently, you know, Congress is going to get fuller briefings today on the Hill. But what are the Republican lawmakers being told?
They were given a lengthy briefing at the White House on where this intelligence stands at the time. And some members of Congress said it's still very much up in the air. They have not proven this yet. But again, things like this are really hard to prove.
So intelligence is verified before it reaches the president of the United States. And in this case, it was not verified.
I know at the White House yesterday that the press secretary was saying there are dissenting opinions about the intelligence. And it wasn't elevated to the president's level because there was no consensus among the intelligence community. That, too, is very common. The president doesn't always get intelligence that's absolutely verified. Now, some members of Congress said they didn't. Adam Kinzinger said he did not think it would rise to the level of the president, and it may well not have risen to the level of the president. Of course, we know he denies ever being briefed about this, and the DNI has backed him up on that, saying he was never briefed, nor was the vice president on this.
Who knew what, when, and did the commander-in-chief know? And if not, how the hell not? What is going on in that process?
I think the thing that's curious, Brad, however, is if you started hearing about these reports, and in fact, the White House has much confirmed that there were reports that this was happening, you would think the president would want to know about it.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it seems bizarre. Like, to me as a layman, it seems bizarre. Is that the way that defense officials and intelligence officials would think?
I think intelligence officials would say, okay, the story's out there, whatever you think of it. Don't you want to know whatever you can about whether or not this actually happened? Even if it isn't proven yet, even if it isn't verified, if there are reports now circulating, and they've been reported by major news organizations, and military officials are telling major news organizations about this, you would think that they would want to know more about this and whether or not Russia, in fact, was behind a plot like this.
As an event with Netanyahu was wrapping up, Trump told reporters to stay. He had something to say about that infamous Oval Office meeting with Russian officials, about those reports that he passed on highly classified intelligence given to the United States by the Israelis.
I never mentioned the word or the name Israel. Never mentioned it.
We also know that there are senior U.S. officials who say they don't really like to bring up Russia in briefings to the president because he doesn't really want to hear about it.
Intelligence briefings took place perhaps once or twice a week.
Is that unusual?
It's very unusual. They should take place every day.
And, you know, it was just a short time ago that I talked to John Bolton, and he said basically the president spends most of his time talking during the briefings, not really listening to the briefings, and that he doesn't read very much.
I was going to say, you could make a case for it. You know, the president just wasn't told. We can talk about why that's the case. But if the president still doesn't seem to want to know the details of this, even if everyone else is learning about it, what the thought process is there in the White House. Martha Raddatz in Washington. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, is it censorship, responsibility, or just corporate lip service? Why more and more platforms are taking down controversial content? More after the break.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer.
We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
As the outrage of George Floyd's death transformed into a variety of conversations, one of the debates over race in America has been how much responsibility platforms have.
Controversy over Senator Tom Cotton's New York Times op-ed this past week, which was on violence in protests across the country. His piece Wednesday titled, Send in the Troops.
For years, lots of media outlets and websites and college campuses have said, we're here to air all kinds of political views. The counterargument has been, that's great in theory, but what if amplifying those messages puts people in real danger? Well, yesterday, we saw more platforms pulling down content. Some of it that came directly from President Trump himself. Let's go to ABC's Catherine Sands, who covers technology, social media, and misinformation. I mean, Catherine, they call this deplatforming, right? Who exactly is being deplatformed here?
Yeah, Brad, exactly. Deplatforming. So this week we saw the blogging site Reddit. It banned a subreddit called The Donald, which was popular with fans of Donald Trump. We also saw Twitch, which is a video game streaming site. They suspended the official Donald Trump channel that was launched in October 2019.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best.
They said it violated its rules on hate speech, and among the violations was the rebroadcast of a campaign rally in 2015.
They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists.
So that video was removed, as well as a broadcast of Trump's rally in Tulsa this month.
It's 1 o'clock in the morning, and a very tough, you know, I've used the word on occasion, hombre. A very tough hombre is breaking into the window.
So Twitch definitely taking a strong line there and saying this is hate speech and this violates our rules.
Well, so how big of a deal are these moves then when you take down content or when you remove groups like this?
You know, the Twitch move is interesting because they are taking something down completely. A lot of times with platforms, what we see is them flagging the content.
And the president adding, quote, any difficulty and we will assume control. But when the looting starts, the shooting starts.
Putting up a warning with the content or just putting something in there where they can say, we are showing you that we don't approve of this.
Twitter then flagging his comments, saying the tweet violated rules about glorifying violence.
But we're still letting it exist because freedom of speech. But the Twitch move is interesting because they are definitely, that's a very strong move. The Reddit move, you know, on the surface, it might appear to be a strong move because they are, you know, basically banning this subreddit, which was a really popular pro-Trump subreddit.
The Donald was like a huge traffic driver. I remember the campaign even got memes from people that posted on that subreddit.
Yeah, yeah. It was very, 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 very popular back in, I mean, it was founded in 2015. It was very popular in 2016, 2017. But in recent years, there's definitely been a move away from it.
They are going hard after Donald Trump's
kind of a gradual move just when Reddit started kind of stepping up their moderation.
The r/_Donald subreddit, Donald Trump's pretty much official subreddit, has been quarantined.
And then in November 2019, you had basically all the users of this, the subreddit, the Donald, migrate from Reddit. So they all left Reddit and they went to a site that they created themselves. It was actually a different, completely different site. It's called thedonald.win. And it's almost identical to Reddit in its appearance, and in its style and in the way that you engage with the content. But they marketed it as something that they wouldn't have to worry about censorship.
Reddit has gone full-scale potato communist out there.
So they did this as like a preemptive move because Reddit was kind of beginning the rumblings of, you know, we need to do something, or they were kind of getting a lot of pressure on them. So to me, it just feels a bit more of a gesture than it does actually going a long way to censor content on their platform that does promote hate or violence, because I'm sure that there are plenty of subreddits that do that without having to go back to the one that was made famous for being pro-Trump.
Well, yeah, and so let's be clear here. These companies could have done any of this before, right? So why didn't they? Is it because they're paying lip service, as you seem to be saying? Or, I mean, is there a new calculus perhaps in Silicon Valley that they're also trying to deal with?
I mean, it's almost certainly the upcoming election.
The Russian accounts manipulated or created memes and images, some in support of President Trump.
Today, I want to share some new policies that we're putting in place and adopting to connect people with authoritative information about voting, to crack down on voter suppression, and to fight hate speech.
It's almost certainly the fear of being held responsible, being blamed for misinformation, for interference, for, you know, disinformation tactics, for manipulating voters.
Oh, if we see big exposés in December of 2020 saying a lot of voters were swayed by this website, like nobody, those websites don't want to be that story.
Exactly. They don't want to be that story. They saw it happen to Facebook after 2016 and they said, we don't want to be that. And it's almost certainly because of the election. But also, Brad, what we are seeing a lot now is companies, brands, advertisers putting a lot of pressure on social media companies.
The Anti-Defamation League, the NAACP, and others have launched the hashtag Stop Hate for Profit campaign and are calling on advertisers to pull their Facebook ads during the month of July.
They're kind of thinking, well, maybe we should stop or halt or suspend some of our advertising on Facebook because they're seeing the flack that Facebook is getting for, you know, leaving content up that contains inaccuracies or flagging content that contains inaccuracies and leaving it up anyway.
Verizon is joining a growing boycott of Facebook. The world's largest telecommunications company is withholding advertising until Facebook does more to crack down on hate speech.
So I think, you know, perhaps it's a bit of PR, perhaps it's a bit of saving face. They want to make sure that whatever happens, if any of this content perhaps affects the electoral process or influences it in any way, they don't want to be associated with that. And they want to be able to say that they took the action and they did what they could at the time.
Yeah, I know the rationale from a lot of media outlets has been, hey, if the president says something, even if it's incendiary, because it's the president, that will have real ramifications. That is newsworthy. People should know about it. Some of these companies making the choice, they're not going to amplify these messages regardless of who they come from. Catherine Sands, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brad.
And one last thing. I'm sure all of you are so anxious to get back on an airplane right now, but the Boeing 737 MAX is back in the air. You remember when two 737s crashed in Indonesia and Ethiopia barely 6 months apart?
In both crashes, a faulty sensor sent bad data to a system called MCAS. That faulty sensor caused the system to misfire, forcing the plane's nose down over and over again, even as pilots fought to gain altitude.
That was all more than a year ago, and since that time, those models have not been allowed to fly in the U.S. and several other countries.
And hopefully they'll very quickly come up with the answer, but until they do, the planes are grounded.
Well, yesterday, after some tests by Boeing, special FAA pilots boarded a MAX and gave it a spin, part of a series of tests that Boeing hopes will recertify the plane.
And even if the test does go well, a new pilot training procedure will need to be approved, among other reviews.
And remember, Boeing was losing all this money because no one wanted to buy the 737 MAX all of a sudden. Then when it wanted to start building them again, COVID-19 hit. No one wanted to fly any plane. Well, now the company hopes to level itself, but there is plenty of turbulence. The recertification could take months. Every U.S. airline is now asking customers to sign an agreement they'll wear masks in the wake of mid-air arguments.
I'm sorry that you don't like it, but I mean, I don't like wearing a mask.
Well, I'm going to ask you to come off the aircraft.
And just because you've seen images of packed flights does not mean we are hurting for aircraft in this country. More people went through airports this weekend than any day since the pandemic began. That was still 76% lower than what we're used to. Travel experts say it might never be the same. Customers seem to not want to go to other countries right now if it means risking an infection, even if their aircraft passes all of its tests. It's interesting. You're starting to see people refer to COVID records, like the most passengers since COVID became a thing, the new normal. Start here tomorrow. Hit subscribe if you haven't already. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability? And would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.